Good evening, Portland. It is 7 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio 90.7.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dundee Lodge Campout Volume 2, the Fringe Art and Music Festival on August 16th, 17th, and 18th at Dundee Lodge in Gaston, Oregon. Dundee Lodge Campout Volume 2 features art, unlimited camping spots, a full bar, food carts, a nearby lake, and performances by Marisa Anderson, Pink Reason, Amps for Christ, Lavender Flu, and many, many more. This is an all-ages event. Again, that's Dundee Lodge Campout Volume 2, the Fringe Art and Music Festival, August 16th, 17th, and 18th at Dundee Lodge, 50845 Southwest Dundee Road in Gaston, Oregon. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel in Portland. Bonds Over Borders is a benefit for Innovation Law Lab, a Portland-based organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants at detention centers, both locally and around the country. There will be live stand-up sets from Adam Passy and Dan Weber, and live music by Pedro Queriega. Again, that's Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at Ace Hotel, 403 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening. Good evening and welcome to Popular Education. My name is Tammy and I'm so glad to be here with you. In the studio today, I have special guests. How's it going? We have Patty and Austin. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, guys.
Hey, how's it going? It's a pleasure to be here with you. So today we have our two-part special, or I guess the second part of a two-part special, about the Summer of Love, 1969. Last week we talked about Nixon and his failed reform, welfare reformed, and it was a joke. It was awesome. We talked about it. Lots of laughs, lots of giggles, lots of hard-hitting fact about how general elected officials can very harmfully harm people. But there are other people who get together and decide to come together and create a better existence for the rest of us. And those are the kind of people that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, that's neat. That's the second part of it. Is, mm-hmm. Definitely listen to that first one. And Nixon, a lot of Nixon, and a lot of speeches.
Yes.
Silly speeches.
Yeah.
And
they tried.
And now we're going to be talking about that beautiful aspect of 69 and Woodstock.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't even know where to start. There's so much. We are going to, I guess, just start off with talk about the founders of Woodstock. And that'll be Artie Kornfeld, Michael Lang, John Roberts, and Joel Roseman. They're the founders of the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair. So it wasn't just a music festival. The founders of Woodstock were kind of a weird bunch, you could say. You've got these two like highbrow businessmen and then these two other like quasi hippies, for lack of a better word.
Oh yeah, definitely. They
yeah.
just kind of knew it was the difference between education and knowing people, and
yeah.
Michael and Artie definitely were in the business and were taking that aspect, where the other two were the money.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know,
financiers. And originally, John Roberts and Joel put out an ad which read something along the lines of, "Two businessmen with unlimited capital looking for venture ideas."
That's genius.
It really is.
Ask for people's money, you know, to
start. They're like, we have the money. We just want your ideas.
Yeah, just ideas. And mm-hmm. sponsoring that, that's hilarious.
Yeah. Man. I don't think people even read the newspaper. I always look for ads that are strange like that. Like, just, you know, they say that one of the founding members of KISS, they just put out an ad in the newspaper that's like, I don't know, I think it's like, guitarist willing to do anything to make it. You know, it's like, yeah, let's get back to stuff like that. But So they put the ad out in the paper, and I don't think that any one of the four founders of Woodstock understood what kind of impression the festival will leave on society 50 years later. So today, we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of the 1969 Woodstock celebration. 50 years ago, over 10,000 to 500,000 youths. I know we have a little skepticism about the numbers.
It's hard to gauge.
You say 500,000, and then there's another million waiting in the New York highway like or something.
That. With no ticket sales, then
it's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I can't really get back to it to see what the numbers were. So 1.5 million, let's just say that, youths gathered on a 600-acre dairy farm in the town of Bethel, New York. At this time of the party, listeners were, I think, listening to Ravi Shankar. I don't know. I wasn't there. If you were there and you want to talk to us a little bit about it, I don't know if I can put you on air, but I definitely would love to hear it. You can call us at 503-231-8187. But
yeah, none of us were there, so yeah, if y'all call in,
that'll be awesome.
Just any kind of little story,
mm-hmm,
I would just be neat to hear that.
Yeah, we'd love to hear it, because I know that for me personally, that era it has so much interesting. It's a complex time where a lot of things happen at once, and it's definitely has, not only has it resonated with people now, but it also, to look back 50 years ago, that, you know, 50 years ago, what were people doing on this day versus what people are doing on this day now, and how things have changed, and how maybe we can even learn, and I don't know, or not learn. I really don't know.
Well, no, just hearing about it, yeah. I mean, just especially for that event too, like people mm-hmm. were traveling across the country.
Mm-hmm.
To go to this free show
for a positive love filled free show, you know,
love, yeah, peace and music.
Yep, there you go. 3 days. Yep, that's true. So with that being said, I'm gonna try to, I just with the time schedule, so it was in New York, so that's 3 hour difference, right? So let's say this is more or less what people were listening to at Woodstock in 1969. Thank you. 69. Other things happened in 68.
great Ravi Shankar. Gentleman who played through the rain, who just kept playing.
Thank you so much, Ravi. That was Ravi Shankar playing at Woodstock in 1969.
Maybe.
And over here in the studio, I am with guests, special friend guests.
Hello.
Hey, how are you? Patty and Austin, how's it going?
Doing good.
Yeah.
What a great song to start with our Woodstock.
Yeah.
Like, that definitely
was so
with the
psychedelic sitar.
Yeah. And, yeah, the drums. And, yeah, that was, and then also the little mention of the mud. we're going to be getting into that, too. I mean, what an event, though. But, yeah, so many awesome, awesome artists that played in such a short time and got into the event, and yeah, just like some beginning, some popular, some just like not even know that they're there.
And some I hear, like, let's not mention, I won't mention how I heard that the Grateful Dead were horrible, because I know there are a lot of Grateful Dead fans out there, but I heard that they were horrible, and if that's true or not true, you can always call in and let me know. But that is true. A lot of people got their start, a lot of people didn't even really quite like even make it after Woodstock, but it's still cool to say that they were there, I think.
Yeah, you know? Like Carlos Santana, no one, apparently what I've heard is no one even knew about him before he started coming on stage there. Everyone's like, who is this? This is amazing. And then he comes out with Soul Sacrifice.
Yeah,
such a beautiful song.
We are going to be playing that one later as well. I definitely dig
Stay
that
tuned.
One. Stay tuned. But with Woodstock and all the great music, you know, I got to kind of, I don't know. I don't think that from the documentaries I've watched and the research, again, I'm not a historian. I just did a lot of research for this episode. From all of the documentaries and the people who talked to me about Woodstock, I don't think that anyone can really explain it, what it was, the idea of it, because the founders themselves, the four fellas that we mentioned, they didn't even, you know, plan for it to be what it became. And it seems like just one of those you should have been there kind of things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But what I can talk about is the climate, you know, like the political and social climate of the time during the 60s that kind of escalated to the 1969s and or to the year 1969 and then to, I don't know, this? I don't know. Was it even an underlining, like, you know, did the conflict and the war and, you know, civil rights and everything, did that contribute to the atmosphere at Woodstock? I don't know.
That's what we're
I
talking.
Wasn't there,
we,
you know?
Yeah, I mean, none of us were there, by the way. Once again, call us in if you were there. That'd be neat to hear a story. But yeah, it's the, it had to have happened because there was such turmoil in civil rights and presidencies and
assassinations. Yeah, yeah.
And like we were discussing this earlier about like they had to do it for free too. And if it all these like great fortunate events led to an awesome experience that no one knew at the time was going to be legendary, because you know you don't know when
you
it's
don't
a
know
legend
it,
and so all that just kept on just making an awesome snowball of greatness. And everything somehow landed together with such a different idea at the beginning and then had to evolve as they went.
Yeah, they definitely have to have been very flexible. And yeah, I mean, they, you know, we'll get about the whole money thing later, but yeah, they end up being a free concert just because it just, how can you contain that many people with no fence and no, you know, you just, they couldn't do it. So like we were mentioning, you know, was the climate of the time like a contribution of the atmosphere at Woodstock? I don't know, but you know who does know and who was there? My good buddy Arlo Guthrie. He's not a friend of mine. I wish he was, but I have this recording that I found of him just kind of talking a little bit about the climate and about the, you know, just like the political and just social climate of the time. So here's just like a really short recording of him, and we'll be right back.
Every time there were 50 more kids in the street somewhere, there was a police riot going on. People were getting shot just hanging around talking about stuff. This wasn't just some fun time, you know, like peace and love, man. There were people getting hurt and killed and stuff. It was a time of extreme opposites. While Richard Nixon bombed Vietnam, LSD guru Timothy Leary ran for governor of California.
I think we'll win. We want to turn on the whole state.
Just weeks after man first set foot on the moon, the Manson family went on a brutal murder spree.
There were as many kids of that age at Woodstock that weekend as there were in Vietnam.
And we are back. That, you know, that was Woody. Excuse me, I keep saying Woody Guthrie. That was Arlo Guthrie, who was Woody Guthrie's son. We got a phone call.
Yeah, we got a phone call. That was delightful. A person just told me, just wanted to mention that the cultural, like he was talking about Santana and the like culture that it brought, like it was mm-hmm. a lot different. And he also mentioned that the drummer was 16 at the time.
Oh, wow.
So like, I mean, yeah, kind of like a thrown together. It sounds like, I mean, a lot of the bands, like including Jimi Hendrix, I knew was just kind of a bunch of his friends mm-hmm. getting together and eventually, you know, making it happen. So yeah, thanks for that call, by the way.
Thank you so much, really appreciate it. And just in case you are just tuning in, my name is Tammy. You're listening to Popular Education. We're here at the K Boo Studios in Portland, Oregon. I'm here with my friend guests, I'm not sure how I'd say that, Patty and Austin.
Yeah.
How's it going? So we just listened to a little ditty, and also it was The Age of Aquarius playing in the background. That was Arlie. I'm really just struggling with his name. Arlo Guthrie. And as he so eloquently expressed, the 60s were a time of political and civil unrest, Civil Rights Act of 64, the Korean War, Vietnam War, the death toll of young men, and, you know, like I mentioned in my last episode, the death of Kennedy, the MLK's assassination in 68. The people were finding new ways of living and adapting things like Eastern philosophies, things like living in communes, integration of blacks and white students, and feminism. I think it was in the 60s they were burning bras. Yeah.
Yep.
And look at us now. No one deals with those things. I guess you don't know that, but now you know. I'm letting you know. So meanwhile, the four founders of Woodstock were all kind of like well-off white dudes who wanted to put on a small concert with the proceeds of the concerts, they wanted to finance a new record studio called Woodstock Records.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it never really, you know, they never really set off for Woodstock to become what it was, but you know, they dealt with so many things. I know, Patty, you were talking earlier.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, I was saying that it just led into it, but
they had so many.
They had a lot of
problems.
They had funding, and so they were bringing mm-hmm. Big artists, and then it just kept on going mm-hmm. from there. And then everyone just heard about it, and it spread like wildfire.
It did. Yeah. And as a date for the festival was approaching. I mean, they had to deal with things like, and even, you know, it's even with a lot of money, these things just happen. They had to rebook the venue 21 days before the concert. They ended up having lawsuits, things like, because the cows around in the farmland around the area where they were at, they wouldn't milk for the next while afterwards, which, you know, I don't blame them, you know. And also the fact that they didn't sell any tickets. You know, the location itself had only one toilet per about 800 persons.
Insane.
Right? And fun little ditty, I don't know if you know this, but Pete Townsend of The Who hit Abbie Hoffman of the Youth International Party with his guitar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he hit him right on stage.
Believe it. Yeah.
You believe it.
No, yeah. I was reading a thing about them, too, and they were, just make it really quick, but they were... had a different experience in it because there was just like no money
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't, some musicians just couldn't get out of there
mm-hmm.
after that,
you know,
moving the equipment and whatnot. And yeah, The Who were explaining that, and but what a lightning show that they put on.
Yeah, with the lightning. And Abbie Hoffman was apparently on stage just being like, he was talking about, I think there was like a political prisoner or something, and he was saying how it's not fair to, you know, he was doing, you know, his thing, and Pete Townsend just was not having it. And if anyone was there and happened to see Pete Townsend hit Abbie Hoffman over the head with a guitar, I would love to hear that, because I was trying to find footage of that, and I guess that was like the one thing that wasn't filmed. And again, phone number is 503-231-8187, KBOO Studios. My name is Tammy, listening to Popular Education. So the fact that the whole thing, I don't want to say it was a mess, because it wasn't a mess. It was just DIY-ish, rustic. Was it a catalyst of the time? That's my question at the end of the day, you know?
Yeah, they did what they could. They they had to change places at the last second. They had to build a stage from nothing. Mm-hmm. They had months built into the first place, and then afterwards they had, I think it was a week and a half. And on day four, where they had like 4 or 5 days left, they had a month's worth of work to do. So they basically went to the guys and said, you know, I can build the stage or I can build the fence. And so then it became what it was. It was free.
The stage.
Free for all.
Thankfully, they chose the stage.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I wonder what they would choose these days.
Yeah, well, they'd be playing the mud if they didn't choose a stage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. So I have another little recording that I'd like to play. And this is actually really neat. It's going to go a little bit more about kind of like the finances and, you know what? You're just going to listen to it. And we'll be back in just a couple of moments.
Security in 1969 was a serious matter. Just a year earlier, in the summer of 68, civil rights and anti-war protests had erupted into riots across America. Wes Pomeroy, who is now deceased, was in charge of security.
I worked for Wes. So Wes and I went and made a deal with the police commissioner at the time that we were going to be able to interview and hire a number of New York City policemen. They were going to come up and be our police, except the night before the festival, the police commissioner got cold feet. I don't know what happened. There was political pressure in New York. And they said, no cops. There was a policeman at the 6th Precinct, an officer in charge, who went ahead and gathered us, a group of about 300 police people who would not give us their real names. We had to pay them in cash.
As the last days of preparation dwindled, Michael pushed his crews day and night. John and Joel were working the phones at their headquarters in an old telephone building a mile away from the site. No one is quite sure where Artie was.
Four guys in our 20s, we had never produced an event like this. We were hiring good people, but it turns out that creating a small city, or in that case, the third largest city in New York, as it turned out, for that weekend, requires a lot more than what we had put together.
On the morning of August 13th, 1969, 2 full days before the festival was set to begin, the construction crew showed up for work as usual. But something unusual was happening. 50,000 early birds had already arrived.
Nobody knew it was going to be gargantuan. The gargantuan thing happens when you realize that you're not done. And you're never going to be done. They're already coming. You know, they're over the hill and they're here.
Max had refused to let Mel Lawrence, who was the head of operations, put up the fencing lest the cows that morning not give milk. So the fencing issue had been relegated to the last moment.
Michael woke me up here. It was like 6 and he said, you won't believe it. There was 50,000 people out there on the field, you know. So we knew at that point there was no gates.
If they were there 2 days early, then these thoughts that we were having that maybe we would get to 100,000 people seemed trivial.
There were maybe 50,000 people on the infield, and they said, you want to clear the infield, we want to start taking tickets now. And we said, do you want a good movie or a bad movie?
The choice was to try to collect money and risk a riot, or to begin the dizzying process of surrender.
There was this moment on Wednesday before the festival began where I was still thinking, we can still do it. We can get these gates up. We can collect tickets. This is going to work. It's going to be just fine.
You don't even have to bother to bring your tickets or anything because they aren't going to collect them. There's no way they can. They got a fence that's like half up and there are people just sitting in that field. It's really beautiful.
The team made a lame attempt to secure fences around the site, but it was too late. Film producer Bob Maurice and director Michael Wadley had been trying for weeks to raise money to capture the festival on film. As the hours counted down, they grew more determined. They went to Artie for help. Artie went to Joel and John.
I said, I wasn't born yesterday. Documentaries never make any money. And, I mean, you'll have to go somewhere else.
Artie knew Fred Weintraub, who was in the movie division at Warner Brothers.
So I just called him up and said, guys, I want to talk to you. And I walked in and said, would you shoot dice with $100,000? And if this is a disaster, you'll have the best disaster movie in all time.
The day before the music started, Warner Brothers put up $100,000, and Woodstock, the movie, was born.
And it kind of happened like everything else happened. It just sort of came together.
And I remember waking up around 5:30, 6 o'clock, Friday morning, and I just opened and I said, holy, what is going on here?
And I looked out, and I saw thousands and thousands of smiling faces.
Everything was peaceful in this town. When I came down here Friday morning, I couldn't believe my eyes.
Now, who knew that people would get into a traffic jam and say, screw it, I'm just going to leave my car here? Who would ever figure that? I mean, that's never happened before.
Everything was tied up. There were thousands of abandoned cars along 17B.
There were, you know, 500,000 people there and another million on the road trying to get there. And this is a small rural community that is reached by a two-lane road.
Just one lane going all the way up to the site.
We saw a little corn patch converted into about the third or fourth city in the size city in the state of New York. City size, maybe a Rochester. Just one of those things that would almost scare you to see all these thousands of children in, out in the field.
Coming up, first day of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair, 500,000 rock and roll pilgrims sat in a farm field waiting for their musical heroes to appear. As the crowd continued to swell, the mood backstage was tense.
There was immediately a feeling of failure for the event, the promoters to make their money, all of that. Here's these fences that didn't really hold up.
The question was whether or not to accept the financial loss and officially announce that the concert was free. To John Morris, the answer was obvious.
Of course it was a free concert, they were already in there. But we had a conversation.
You are now giving the world's greatest three-day freebie.
Okay, that's what it is. No, there's a way to do it. Walk to my office, call John and Joel and said, John, guys, this is the deal. This is what I think should happen. It's your tales.
By this time, it was clear that unless we charged admission, we were going to be broke, beyond broke. We were going to be in the hole, and it would take us a long time to dig out of that hole. Maybe never.
People came prepared to buy tickets. Why not take their money? What's the problem with that?
We might have a riot on our hands. The largest assemblage of people prior to that had rioted in Chicago.
In 2 seconds, both of them said, go do it. So I walked up on stage.
It's a free concert from now on.
And from that moment on, the audience was in it with us.
It was just,
we can't do the one song.
What it means is that the people who are put backing this thing, who put up the money for it, are going to take a bit of a bath. A big bath. That's no hype, that's true. They're going to get hurt.
They were panicked. I mean, the money was hemorrhaging. It wasn't just flowing, it was hemorrhaging out the door.
The weekend of the festival, we were over $1 million in debt. And of course, the ticket money had somewhat dried up. As a result of no gates being there to collect revenues.
John and Joel had, you know, they had big fish to fry, and they were all dying on the plate.
By the first day of the festival, after 8 months of spending, Woodstock Ventures had accrued $3.4 million in expenses. Against the $250,000 they had borrowed and the $1.3 million in ticket sales, they were now nearly $2 million in debt. John Roberts was in hell.
I did have to make a call on Friday to the bank to say, this is going to cost me pretty much everything I have.
Forget the ticket booths, forget anything, forget a thought that had to do with anything other than keeping these people safe and giving them the show of their lives.
People out there, get away from the scaffolding, please.
Because anything less than that, I felt, was far too dangerous.
Michael and Artie were having a very different experience.
It was not threatening. None of it was threatening. All of it was very positive and very supportive, and every place you went, you felt it.
We just stood there with our arms around each other, just staring, you know? It might have mattered more to Joel and John because they were invested financially.
John and Joel were on one side of the fence, and Michael and Artie were on another.
It became a pattern after a while that it was kind of us against them. It was Michael and the production people letting us know as little as possible about how far over budget we were going to be.
Michael and Artie were, it's cool, man.
These people are communicating with each other. That rarely happens anywhere anymore.
Right. It has nothing to do with money.
Artie was on Planet Nine. He was having a good time.
Artie, how you doing, man?
I'm excited.
Good to see you, man.
Glad
you can make the story.
John and Joel had been grown up as responsible, suburban young men who had a very different take on life than Artie and Michael.
Financially, this is a disaster. But you look so happy.
I'm very glad you got there, man. You couldn't buy that for anything.
I got to call my family over the weekend and say, you know, I'm getting in way over my head.
John had these very straight parents that he knew he was going to be answering to, and they were on the phone. I believe the brother was around somewhere at that point.
If I'm going to be writing checks, I want to make sure that they're going to clear, and I'm going to have to fall back on you.
John was shaken up a great deal of the time, and so was Joel.
My father and my brothers said, do what you have to do. They got a lot of credit with me, but I don't think the world ever realized how much they had invested themselves personally in my particular madness.
The tension that existed between Michael's, Artie, John, and Joel had reached excruciating proportions.
And so, as the four partners each drifted into their own personal heaven or hell, the divine madness that was Woodstock continued. It was time for the musicians to play.
People were talking about a disaster, and we were going to have to be flown in by chopper or something, and it was still daylight, and we could look down and see people as far as the eye could see. Suddenly, I realized this was out of hand. This was a free-for-all. This was going to be fun. It was the moment I realized that there were so many more of us than them for the first time in a long history and a long battle and struggles with people getting shot on the streets and stuff. This was our moment. And I remember getting there and feeling like, whoa, this is it.
Good evening. My name is Tammy, listening to Popular Education. And today in the studio, I have special guest friends, friend guests, Patty and Austin. And you're just listening to a little tidbit from this awesome documentary that's actually a VH1 Behind the Music Woodstock documentary. If you aren't familiar with it, you should get yourself familiarized. And with that being said, Patty and Austin are a couple of Portland's most treasured, underrepresented, underdogs of the musical scene here in Portland, Oregon, okay? And they are amazing musicians, and they had decided to grace us today with some great music by CCR. We're going to... do you want to introduce it? Or?
Yeah. We were... Thank you for that build-up.
Yeah, you're welcome. The most amazing musicians I've ever heard in my life.
Super underground.
Underground, underappreciated.
But yeah, we were talking about songs that we could do, and CCR definitely was number one, because this is one of our first songs that we started playing.
And they played this song on
CCR, yeah, I believe it was second day.
So
and,
tomorrow.
So tomorrow, CCR is playing this song.
Tomorrow,
50 years ago. But we're going to play this song now, today. And yeah, so yeah, let's do it, Austin.
All right, here we go.
So much. That was amazing.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us, and thank you CCR.
Thank you CCR. Absolutely. Number one.
John
number
Fogarty,
one.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
By the way, and
yeah,
all beautiful songs, and yeah, I mean, like we were saying earlier, none of us went to Woodstock, mm-hmm, and it's neat that we're talking about this, how much it influenced us to in our lives, you know. We're playing
just as people and musicians.
Yeah, and musicians, yeah, and just life and everything. So it's very, once again, call in if you were there or have a story about it or where you were at. The number is 503-231-8187.
Yes.
And
yeah, go ahead. And I was just wondering, like, as musicians, because I know, you know, how it influenced me, but as musicians, I know what you're into, but has Woodstock and the music of that time influenced you in any way as musicians in our current, you know, 50 years later? I guess obviously since you're playing it right now, but you know, like what are your opinions?
Yeah, I mean, definitely influenced. I remember watching it at my friend's house, first band I was in at his house, watched a little documentary and, you know, watching Santana.
I mean, that's really the
Santana and seeing him play. And
yeah, Santana and Jimmy both were like the big hitters for me. But
yeah, and I learned a lot about the song, different musicians that I didn't even know that played. You know, I didn't see the whole thing, but you know, the ones that definitely stand out, you know, Janis Joplin, The Who, and all those ones that were the big hitters at night, and Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah,
and definitely those are all bands that I've listened to and mm-hmm, definitely were influenced at the beginning of my music. A lot changed now, but that's still the, you know, soul, yeah, and backing of what I do. And like I was saying with CCR, we learned a lot of CCR songs. If you don't know them, they're very simple chords and simple structures, but it just sounds so great and fun to play.
Yeah, really. The way they're put together is just beautiful.
Yeah, and it's great that all these bands blessed us in the Woodstock and came out. And like I was saying about The Who earlier, you gotta think, like, as beautiful as the event is, there was definitely behind the scenes, and they were standing in mud and waiting to go on, and helicopters and amps and gear and rainstorm, you know, all these things, and hungry, definitely. And as a musician too, to come up, and not only that, but the time frame was, it started so late and then ended up being Jefferson Starship played at 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. I'm sorry, Jefferson
was,
Airplane.
Yes, Airplane, yes. They did. It was straight. Some very early, and I think they said it, they had their hard rocking night, and then the next morning it was time for the Maniac morning music.
Right. So yeah, definitely, I mean, those people were inspired and to be there that late and early and with nothing. And yeah, I definitely, to answer your question, it's definitely influenced my life and seeing that and the music and the beauty of what people did in that time and brought them together.
Yeah. And just the way that everything came together or fell apart, you know, depending on how, how you look at it.
Immortalized with music.
Yes. And like positivity and like people got together. I have this really short clip that I want to play and I want you to listen to it. It's from a shop owner from the city where Woodstock was, and it's really short and it's just kind of his perception about the concert, the festival goers. Here you go.
My name is Sidney Westerville. I'm the owner of this antique tavern, Munger Valley, New York State. I was here when this crowd really came. We expected 50,000 a day, and there must have been a million. I myself was hungry for 2 days because I couldn't get any food, and I couldn't go out to buy any food. I was eating cornflakes for 2 days. And the kids were wonderful. I have no kick that was saw this and saw that, and thank you this and thank you that. Nobody can complain about the kids. This thing was too big. It was too big for the world. Nobody has ever seen a thing like this. And when they see this picture in the news, in the, well, over the moving pictures, they'll really see something.
That was so lovely. That was so, he said, these guys, these kids, they were great. These fellas, they were awesome. They were, thank you, sir. Thank you, this. Yes, sir. No, sir. Yeah. Two days he ate cornflakes just because so he could let these fellas.
Yeah, just to have a sea of smiles smiling back at you.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
I mean, what and then to have all kinds of walk of people, you know, especially the townspeople, rural area. Yeah.
They're not down for that stuff. No,
happened and they took care of everyone, you know, and things that we're discussing about, like, support that the community definitely gave with airing in food and medical supplies and giving them all kinds of support. And
they ran out of food, and the local people literally took food out of their cupboards and out of everywhere. They just brought it to a school, nearby school, and they airlifted it into the place. It was pretty amazing to hear.
Yeah, and it's again, it's like these people who have otherwise, because they were kicked out of the other place that they were supposed to go to.
Yeah.
And they actually, like, lobbied and petitioned and all that stuff. So it's like, to know that in another place, just like 60, 40 miles away, people were still weirded out by them, but they were like, you know what, they're smiling.
They all came in and they were all there, it's like, well, there's nothing we can do besides help. So they did what they could.
Yes. Gosh, I really enjoyed that recording because it just sounded so genuine and, like, loving. I want to play my favorite song that was played at Woodstock, and afterwards we can wrap up and maybe play another song from our live friend guest friends.
We'll see.
Perhaps. Okay. Here we are listening to Popular Education, KVOO Studios.
Let's welcome Mr. Richie Haven.
Freedom, freedom, freedom.
Good evening. You're listening to Popular Education on KABU. I'm Tammy. We have my surprise friend guest, musical surprise. Guest. Surprise. Ooh. Patty and Austin. That was a Richie Haven motherless child. I really, really, yeah. really love that. That's awesome. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I was just talking to my postman today, and he was just saying he was listening to the album.
Oh, my
and,
gosh. What a great song.
Yeah. It was great song. And freedom. Freedom. Just starting out, the very first word.
Richie said, Richie, and I call him Richie because, you know, we're best friends. Richie said that when he went on stage, the word freedom just came to him.
Yeah.
And Motherless Child is a hymn from when he was 16 years old. He's this hymn that he used to sing to himself, and it just came to him, you know. And all the performers say, we can't describe what it was like performing on Woodstock, you know what I'm saying?
Also want to mention, we just had a caller.
Oh, yes,
and,
yes.
And thank you so much for the support calling us up. And, they just said only great things and about the music, like, and that's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. Like, that was, you know, resonated from the time as well.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
And she was just saying it's very support. And
thank you so much. And thank you, really KABU, too. Thank you, definitely.
I mean, this is
thank you for the airwaves.
Opportunity to tie a community together. And we can, tonight, having talked to, you know, people about it, and it's just neat, you know, just
educating, getting to know the big part of where you're going is knowing where you come from. And speaking of music, are we going to get a little bit more?
We can squeeze another song.
We have a little bit time left. So would you like to introduce this?
Yeah. This another song that was played at Woodstock by one of our favorite bands, The Band. And another song that we just had a go-to and just playing around campfires. So haven't played for a while, but...
we appreciate it. Thank you so much.
And thanks for having us. And here we go.
Pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about past dead. Just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me, may I find a bed? Just grinned and shook my hand, no was all it said. Take a load off Annie, take a load for free. Take a load off Annie. Put the load out on me. Picked up my bags, went looking for a place to hide. And I saw old Carmen and the devil walking side by side. I said, hey, Carmen, come on, let's go downtown. She said, got to go, but my friend can't stick around. Take a load off Annie, take a load for free. Take a load off Annie, and put the load out on me. Go down, Miss Moses, say it's just old Luke, and Luke's waiting on Judgment Day. Well, Luke, my friend, what about young Annalie? Said, do me a favor, son, won't you stay and keep Annalie company? Take a load off Annie, take a load for free. Take a load off Annie. Put the load right on me. Crazy chest followed me and caught me in the fall. Said, I'll fix the wreck if you'll take Jack Doll. I said, wait a minute, Chester, you know I'm a peaceful man. Said, that's okay, boy, won't you feed him when you can? Take a load off Annie, take a load for free. Take a
the load right on me. Catch the cannonball, now take me down the line. My bag is sinking low, and I do believe it's time to get back to Miss Fanny. You know she's the only one. Send me here with her and God's for everyone. Take a load off Fanny. Take a load for free. Take a load off Fanny. And you put the load right on me.
Thank you so much. That was fantastic. That was Patty and Austin covering the band's The Weight.
Yeah.
The band.
Yeah. The Weight.
Not if you guys know the song, we're missing a key aspect of it, the keyboard, but it does it does sound good anyways. I love that song.
Maybe another singer would have helped them, but yeah. With the and part. But no, another awesome song that we chose with in lieu of the event that we call Woodstock.
The anniversary,
And
50 years to the day.
Yeah, 50 years. That was fantastic. That was really nice. And it definitely, I think, captured the spirit. You know, just good, positive, happy,
and
love.
And another, the diversity of that. Mm-hmm. Our first caller talking about, the culture and in so many different styles of bands playing. You know, just you have Santana, Janis Joplin,
Jimi Hendrix. And when I was looking at pictures and videos, you know, I thought I was going to see the same kind of homogeneous kind of cookie cutter kind of person, but it was not like that. And I'm so happy that it was. You know, it's good to know that we can do it, and hopefully we can aspire to do well in the future and learn. Like you were saying earlier, that people try to remaster what was, and it's just impossible to do. You can't.
Yeah, the Woodstock 50 failure. And
They tried,
but another important thing is, it's the remembering of it. You know, you can't recreate that.
Yeah.
And to do something like that, it wouldn't happen anymore. It's just in a different time of money and different artists. We were discussing that it might have been that a different artist that wouldn't have played, but the memory will always be there.
Yes, and definitely
immortalized forever.
Yeah,
and especially if people keep enjoying that kind of music and that style of
mind frame of life.
Yeah, then we can keep carrying that on. Maybe it can. A fortunate event, just like Woodstock.
Yeah.
Maybe the world could be better and turn into Woodstock. The world.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're saying, I know Austin was telling me earlier how the dairy farmers, they were the person, Mark something or other, I forgot. I should probably know since I was researching. I can't pronounce last name. He was saying how he was ashamed of himself, thinking that the people that went to Woodstock were just going to wreak havoc on the area and just mess everything up. But
worried
he was
about
just,
all that could go wrong.
Oh, but there was no. Yeah. No environmental impact.
No,
hardly. I was
two people did perish in the festival from an overdose, and I do believe it was sleeping under a tractor.
And it wasn't because of violence. It wasn't of a quarrel or anything like that.
Yeah, there were, and they had the freak out tents and
fighting. Yeah, I mean.
And it was, I'm just glad that I could do a second part to the Summer of Love and just talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, it was awesome.
And thank you so much, Patty and Austin, for being my friend guests.
Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to come on your show.
Yeah, definitely. I appreciate it. And if you're interested in subjects or want to speak with us, any questions, comments, concerns, you can hit us up on Popular Education Radio on Instagram or PopularEducationRadio@gmail.com. I just want you to remember to be kind to yourself and each other. We are all that we have. And if you want to be better, do better. And I recommend you stand for this next song. Thank you so much.